Okay, welcome back to the second hour of Far Out Radio. I'm Scott Spears. Today is Tuesday. It's September the 10th, if you're listening to the program in the archives, and it's 2013. James Corbett of the CorbettReport.com is our guest for the second hour. Making sense of what's going on in our world has never been easy, and it's kind of ironic that in our information age era, we have gotten to a point of information overload. There is so much coming from so many sources, it's hard to stitch together a coherent picture. There's a concept in metaphysical thinking that says perspective adds wisdom to any given situation. And, you know, when you live in a big nation such as the United States of America with its enormous homogenized corporate and government-controlled mass media, it can be very difficult to get an honest read on current events. Therefore, it's very beneficial to get perspectives from outside the United States on geopolitical situations. James Corbett is a Canadian educator, and he's been living and working in Japan since 2004. In 2007, James launched CorbettReport.com as a platform for his independent analyses of social, political, historical, and economic issues. He has written and produced over 1,000 hours of audio and video presentations, and you can keep up with James's work at CorbettReport.com, and that's spelled C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. We talked with James last July, and you can enjoy that conversation by going to the archives section of Far Out Radio and look for the search tool at the top of the page and just type in James Corbett, and you can listen and enjoy. But with so much going on in that power keg in the Middle East with Syria and the continuing disaster at Fukushima, I thought it would be a good time to have James back on the program to share his perspective on these two very hot situations. James, you're there. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for talking about these important situations, because I think we do need an independent analysis of these, as unfortunately so much of it tends to get lost in the mainstream press through the usual channels of misinformation and propaganda.
Mm-hmm. I came to the conclusion a few years ago that the media, not just the news media, but also the print and entertainment media, is the fourth branch of government, in the sense that it governs how we think. It tells us what our opinions are supposed to be. It tells us who our heroes are supposed to be, and on and on and on. It actually governs our thinking. So we now in America have an unofficial fourth branch of government. Isn't that nice?
Well, it's horrific, of course, but you're exactly right about that. And in fact, I mean, this is something that's not even hidden anymore. They openly brag about this in some cases, such as a few years ago when Fox News and Fox Television released a really interesting little piece of information about how they had started to deliberately insert green messages into all of their programming. And mm-hmm. they put together an interesting little trailer showing some of the instances of this, where basically they were trying to insert these green messages to try to manipulate the public opinion on these matters and to try to change people's behavior. And I suppose it sounds all good and wonderful and welcoming to the planet, but it really is interesting to see how one person like Rupert Murdoch can control this mammoth media organization that deliberately and consciously tries to insert certain messages into all of its programming in order to manipulate the viewers' opinions. And unfortunately, we see this pretty much across the board in a number of different ways. So you're exactly right. Unfortunately, the media, even the entertainment media, has become little more than an adjunct of government and a vehicle for propaganda. And we really mm-hmm. do have to be aware of that at the very least, if not actively working to protect ourselves from that propaganda.
Yes, indeed. Guard your mind. It's a good motto. So where would you like to begin? You want to start off with what's going on in Syria or Fukushima? Either one works for me.
Well, let's talk about Syria, since this is a very interesting situation, but it's still ongoing. And by the time we've finished talking about it, it'll probably have changed. I think Obama's due to address the nation coming up next hour. So it is a moving target, but still a very interesting one.
Well, today, yesterday, it looked very promising that Russia, through Vladimir Putin, said that they were willing to step in and sort of mediate with regard to these chemical weapons. And Syria said, fine, that sounds like fine, we'll cooperate. And now France has a new plan to enforce an international agreement under the UN Security Council with the military option if necessary. They're just not going to leave this military thing alone, are they?
No, they're not. And at the very least, this war agenda is being exposed for what it is. So I suppose that's a good thing. And anything that delays or hopefully scraps altogether the idea of military intervention is for the good, although there are several things that I'm wary about with this plan. One of them being that the idea that that Assad actually did commit the chemical weapons attack of August 21st has now basically been taken off of the table in terms of even the mainstream conversation on this subject. I mean, I thought it was quite interesting how there were a lot of sources, even mainstream sources, that were really questioning the State Department's official line on this, that it was unquestioningly Assad. And we were seeing more and more coverage of the fact that there was literally no evidence whatsoever that they have or that they were presenting to the public that actually linked Assad to those attacks. And in fact, it became something of a truism. I saw everywhere reflected, even in the comment section of mainstream media websites, that pretty much every single person was asking why on earth Assad would do this type of attack while he was already winning the ground offensive against the terrorist insurgency, and B, why would he wait until the UN chemical weapons inspectors were in the country in order to commit such an attack? I mean, it made no sense from any level. So that was interesting to see the pushback that was coming for against the administration for this big lie. But unfortunately, that's been taken off the table. And what I see in the latest coverage about the latest proposal is that now it's basically just assumed, oh, and the August 21st chemical attack, which came from Assad. So that seems to have been removed from the conversation, which is to the detriment, I think, of the conversation, because I think that speaks to the very fundamental lie, which has been used time and time and time again to lead the country into war, which is that that an attack can take place and just be blamed on the political enemy, regardless of whether or not they did that attack, or regardless of whether or not the attack even happened, as in the case of something like the Gulf of Tonkin, where in fact the incident in question never happened, but it resulted in a war resolution from Congress, which authorized LBJ to formally commit troops to Vietnam and kick that conflict off in earnest. So this could have been a chance to really seize on that and to spread the awareness of false flag terrorism even further into the mainstream discourse. So it's unfortunate that that's been swept under the rug. And also, I mean, I think it's interesting to see that the ways that the fundamental conversation on the war powers of the president has also now been swept under the rug to a certain extent, because again, it's important for the American people to confront the fact that America has not declared a war since World War II and has only been involved in various military combat operations that the president basically now believes he can lead the nation into, regardless of whether or not there's a congressional resolution. Supposedly under the War Powers Act, at the very least, there needed to be some sort of congressional authorization, but Obama was starting to assert the privilege of being able to take the nation into war at any time for any reason, in any capacity, and even as in the UN, as in the Libya example, say that the UN can take the lead and that we'll commit forces to a UN operation without congressional authorization. So this is another aspect of things that unfortunately it looks like will not be confronted and will not be hashed out in the way that it might have been if this had actually gone ahead to military intervention. But again, at the end of the day, anything that stops bombs dropping on innocent civilians' heads is for the good. So I'm supportive of that. And hopefully this will actually completely derail the plans for military intervention in Syria.
I certainly hope so. I mean, this is the last thing that these poor beleaguered people of Syria need. There's a strange perception, you know, that comes from the West with regard to Middle East leaders, because they lead oftentimes with a strong hand. But that seems to work over there for them. And if it works for them and they elected them, leave them alone. But we have this other, of course, there's this other agenda that's constantly pushing and constantly at work here. And of course, it's driven by the money interest and the big industrial interest and the interest that come from the City of London Zionist bankers. And it just goes on and on. They are relentless. They truly are.
Unfortunately so, and it's up to all of us to fight back against that agenda and to really, to, as I say, counteract the propaganda, which is constantly flooding us about these issues.
Well, we have music playing in the background, James, so we're going to take our break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes and continue our conversation with James Corbett. And you can keep up with James's work at CorbettReport.com. He's got stacks and stacks, hundreds of actually hours of audio and video interviews that you can listen to and enjoy. So that's the CorbettReport.com is the website, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. Okay, we are back this hour talking to James Corbett, and he's talking with us from Japan. Thanks, James, for getting up so early in the morning. I know it's, what is it, 7 or is it 8
not
or 9?
So early. It's 9:20 a.m., so I hope I'm awake by this point anyway.
You're awake. You're fine now. You know, often I said in the beginning of the program that perspective adds wisdom to any given situation. And sometimes when I sit and I ponder and look at these things, I'd like to switch things around a little bit. And I've often wondered, what kind of a response would come from the government of the United States of America if some other nation, it didn't matter what nation it was, let's say a big one, a strong one, was to say, you know what, America, we don't like your leader. We don't like him. We don't like what you do to your people. You jail more people than anybody else per capita on the planet. You have a war on drugs. You have a militarized police department that uses SWAT teams on innocent people. You taser people with your alleged non-lethal taser weapons. You kill them. And we don't like your... So we're demanding regime change. We want your president to step down now, or we're going to send over the bombers. Imagine what kind of a response that we would get from the United States government if anybody said that to us. But we do that all the time.
Unfortunately so. Yeah, it is amazing. And the double standard is definitely there. And it's extremely apparent in cases, for example, like Syria, where leaked documents have shown that since 2006, the Bush administration started funding and arming the opposition in Syria with an eye towards fomenting some sort of rebellion. So for the last 7 years now, there has been actual support going to the opposition in Syria. And that has obviously only increased since the tensions started there, and now we have all of the foreign-funded, foreign-trained, and foreign terrorist mercenaries who are being shipped into the country by U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And unfortunately, this is just decimating the country, and it goes to show that, again, the rule of international law and all of these high-sounding phrases that they use to talk about institutions like the United Nations, etc., are really nothing other than a front for the new age of American imperialism. And it's not rhetoric to say that. It's not going out on a limb. Unfortunately, decades and decades of just unbridled U.S. Interference in country after country around the world for decades has proven that. And I think that for the first time, perhaps, the American public is really beginning to understand what that is and why that is such a negative thing. And we really have seen in the past few weeks an incredible outpouring of resentment against the government for trying to lead the nation into yet another war of aggression. And a lot of people have been making the point that there are more than enough problems to solve at home before we start meddling in yet another Middle Eastern nation that probably 9 out of 10 people couldn't identify on a map, and no one understands what this has to do with American national security. So this is, I mean, a pretty transparent case of the government basically being used as that big stick by the money interests and others who really do have an interest in knocking down these foreign governments. So the double standard is there, and again, I think people are waking up to this in record numbers, and that is to the good. The more that they press this agenda forward against the public's will, the more people will at least know that they are tyrants and will act accordingly, which is for the good, because a lot of people have been asleep to this agenda for far too long.
Well, despite the efforts, the shuttle diplomacy efforts of our Secretary of State, John.
Hello, Scott. Really, sorry, I lost you there for a second.
Oh, I'm still here. Despite all of his efforts, he has failed miserably to build any kind of a coalition at all, because the only two nations on this planet that are willing to back us are Israel and France. And, you know, the old saying about France is they're ready to fight to the last American, you know, and that's it. The rest of the planet is saying no. No and no. What part don't you understand? Now, if any other nation on the planet was to behave and to sit and ponder and contemplate and should we, shouldn't we, you know, wring our hands and try, you know, we'd be all over them like stink. But here we are.
Wasn't it interesting to see the idea of military intervention being stricken down by the UK Parliament and in such a rousing fashion? I mean, there was no question really that the government had lost, and that was one of the first times in modern political history that a prime minister had been smacked down in UK Parliament for a military intervention or a resolution. So that was quite an interesting turn of events, and it just goes to show what a completely shambolic production this military intervention has been. I mean, it really strikes me that although I think the Syrian intervention has been on the political radar of those interested parties that we've been talking about, and the usual war hawks have been talking about this for years now, like John McCain and others, who literally visits with terrorists and takes pictures of himself with them, and yeah, just bizarre little pieces like that. But we kind of expect that from certain players out there. But to see now the Obama administration really flailing around out there, clearly showing that there's absolutely no plan whatsoever, and having Kerry's off-the-cuff remarks called as a bluff by Putin, and now Obama is being backed into a corner where he can't really proceed with military intervention without being the aggressor in this case in the eyes of the international. I mean, everyone, even the U.S. allies. So this is, I mean, a bizarre production. I don't think we've seen anything like it in recent years. And it goes to show that the neocons, for whatever you can say about them, at the very least they were ruthless and bloody and psychopathic enough to be able to construct their arguments in a way that was impossible to get out of. I mean, when they gave Saddam Hussein the famous ultimatum in the lead up to the 2003 Iraq war, disarm or you will be disarmed, it was a perfect ultimatum in some ways, because there's no way he could have disarmed, because as we know now, he didn't have the WMD. So there was nothing he could possibly have done to satisfy those criteria. So they had decided on war, and they were basically just saying that outright there, and making it appear that there was some sort of choice involved. Well, when you say to Syria, well, disarm your chemical weapons, or we will disarm you, and they agree to do it, well, you've backed yourself into quite a corner there. So it is a bizarre operation that's taking place right now. And again, if it stops people from being killed, that's for the good, and I'm for that.
There's a video that's been floating around on YouTube and various web pages for several years now of a speech that General Wesley Clark gave, where he was talking about conversations he had in the Pentagon right after 9/11, where he had other soldiers who were frightened, upset, saying, there are plans to invade all these countries throughout the Middle East. What for? And yet, you know, and this is coming from General Wesley Clark. You know, this isn't some radical conspiracy theory, and he's not a kidder. So there you go. Anyway, we're going to take our break, and we'll be right back. Okay, we are back, and we're spending time this evening for this hour with our friend James Corbett. He's a Canadian who lives in Japan, so it's always good to get some perspective on world events. James, before the program, I found an interesting post on Washington Post in the Middle East section, in a very long article that said it was titled, Russia Balks at French Plan for UN Security. Council resolution on Syrian chemical arms. It's a very long piece, but there were several interesting little chunks of info in there that I'll quickly tick through. One of them was that support crumbling on Capitol Hill for military strikes. Syria says they're willing to sign an international treaty banning chemical weapons. John McCain is skeptical. Obama has been urging the world leaders to endorse military action, and he's trying to rally a skeptical public in favor of military action. So he's made up his mind. John Kerry says that we must show the world that we will not fall for stalling tactics. And UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says that U.S. attack on Syria would be illegal without UN approval. I don't know how this guy's going to back out of this corner he's painted himself in and save face, but it sure will be interesting.
It will be interesting to watch, if nothing else. You're exactly right about that. And I think that the corner backing out of technique has been presented in this latest proposal. I mean, this is the only way I think possible for Obama to save face at this point, is to basically pretend that it was Kerry's outreach on this issue that started the ball rolling with regards to this disarmament of Syria. And I'm sure they can find a way to prop that up and hype that up and make it look like it was some sort of bold, proactive choice rather than just complete bumbling and off-the-cuff remarks. But however they choose to do it, again, I hope that this does actually completely derail the talk of military intervention, which, it, you know, surprisingly enough, it looked like Congress was not going to approve anyway. So there's definitely been some significant kickback on this particular issue, and that is good to see, that at the very least the public cannot be railroaded into yet another war of aggression in the Middle East just by using jingoistic phrases and basically bunkum from the administration, unlike previous administrations and previous wars. And at least you know, and this particular invasion, they can't pretend that it's a fight against international terrorism, because of course they would be on the side of the international terrorists. So it's a strange situation, and I don't think anyone would have imagined that 12 years after 9/11 that we'd be having this type of conversation to whether or not we should start a bombing in support of Al-Qaeda affiliated terrorist groups. It's a bizarre place to arrive at.
Well, this is what you just said, is part of the linguistic deception, because the media, that fourth branch, that unofficial fourth branch of government, constantly, when they refer to these people, they call them rebels, freedom fighters. They're not. These are hired mercenary killer Al-Qaeda types. Remember, folks, 10, 11 years ago, those horrible videos that were coming out of these Al-Qaeda types who were literally sawing the heads of people off and then, you know, high-fiving it and just that kind of stuff. That's them. It's, of course, now they're older, but the same guys. And now we're helping them.
Absolutely. Well, let me clarify that, of course, my position is that Al-Qaeda's role in 9/11 was that of a patsy, and I think that the 9/11 operations were really committed by well-connected individuals in the higher-ranking places of power in the United States, both in military and industrial and intelligence aspects of that made it happen. So I think Al-Qaeda has been basically a boogeyman that's been created through the media largely. But having said that, of course, these terrorists who are currently in Syria really do affiliate themselves with that ideology at any rate. And we have Jabhat al-Nusra, which has, again, just committed just the most incredible, in a bad way, incredible violations of just basic human standards in the way that they've dismembered little girls piece by piece right there as their families watched, because they, you know, weren't committed themselves to the Islamic jihadist ideology. You've had massacres of Christians in Syria, etc. And no one can say with a straight face that if they were to take over in Syria that things would be for the better, and yet that's exactly what the administration is proposing. And it's a bizarre situation to arrive at.
You touched on something: massacres of Christians. And I have to look around and say, where's the Christian community here in America?
Yes, that's a very good question.
Are you guys asleep or what?
Well, in fact, one of the oldest Christian communities in the world is in Syria, and it is a place where they actually still speak the actual language that Jesus spoke.
Aramaic.
Exactly. Yes, Western Aramaic. So, and that has recently been captured by the terrorist forces. So we're seeing Christians fleeing that community. So this is, I mean, that's a pretty amazing thing. And it is starting to gain traction. I have seen some Christians in the United States mention mentioning it as part of their rallying cry for why we don't want to be supporting these terrorists. But you're right, I don't think it's been really a major point in the discussion. And it just goes to show once again how thoroughly that the church has been co-opted for the war agenda over the last several years. And to the point where basically a lot of the public, unfortunately, is operating on a cartoon political level where it's just some sort of vague, nebulous, everyone in the Middle East is an Arab, is a Muslim, is a terrorist, and that basically justifies any sort of aggression that goes on there. But the public is kicking back against that propaganda now, and we really are seeing something changing in that discourse when it comes to Syria. And again, that is a hopeful sign that perhaps things are changing and the public just isn't going to go along with this anymore.
Well, the American Christian community truly needs to get their racing slicks out to get some extra traction on this, to use my car metaphor. But that aside, this, to pull back a little bit, this bungling and dithering does not surprise me, because we have a leader right now who's basically been driving the bus for 4.5 years. He's in his second term, and I didn't support him. I kind of looked at when this junior senator was running for president of the United States. I thought, really? Does that now qualify you to be the president of the United States? You're a junior senator with no accomplishments to your credit at all as a senator or even a state senator, a constitutional scholar. Yeah, right. He was the other day, I think it was on Monday or Sunday, I saw a story that said that he was trying to figure out whether or not he actually had the authority to do what he wanted to do. It's coming from a constitutional scholar. Isn't this a duh? or get your Cliff Notes out or something. But it doesn't surprise me, because truly nothing that this current administration has done has worked. The economic agenda hasn't worked. The foreign affairs agendas, nothing has worked. They've accomplished nothing. And I guess that's kind of what we get for having a community organizer for a leader. But go back to 08, would we have been any better off with John McCain and Sarah Palin?
certainly not, no.
About the only thing you can say about them is that at least they're ham-fisted thugs and you know who they are. The current guy leads by deception. And that's not much to go on, but I'll take it. James, we got music playing in the background. On the next side of the break, let's talk about Fukushima. Be right back. Okay, we are back and we're rolling quickly into our last segment with James Corbett. James, before we get into the latest bang-up idea on how to solve this problem over there at Fukushima, since you keep a pretty good ear to a lot of different perspectives, have you heard anything from the United Nations? I mean, where is the UN on this thing?
You know, that's a very good question. And to be honest, I haven't covered
Neither
at least.
I.
I haven't covered on my website at least any statements from the IAEA in recent months on this disaster. And the extent, I mean, I know that they've taken tours of the site and the like, but basically this is being left up into the hands of TEPCO and the Japanese government, although they're basically one and the same at this point.
Right. I mean, this is a potentially worldwide disaster. And why, if the UN was such an honest organization like they like to pretend that they are, why they did not issue a clarion call days after the tsunami and the obvious serious trouble with that those plants, why they did not issue a clarion call to all the world's finest scientists, get on a plane to New York right now. We're in trouble. We need ideas, people, now.
Right.
Well, here we are 2.5 years later.
Sorry, I was just going to say, unfortunately, what this exposes is exactly the fact that the IAEA is nothing else than an adjunct of the nuclear energy industry in general. And perhaps the clearest example of that is from a secret agreement that the details have come out in recent years between the WHO and the IAEA that was signed decades ago, that means that the WHO will not pronounce on radiological matters and will not make those types of judgments without the IAEA's approval. So basically, the WHO has basically been muzzled from actually pronouncing on things like this or conducting proper investigations, which means that the true scope of a disaster like Chernobyl, for example, was vastly downplayed. And there are various estimates as to how many people were actually killed by that disaster, with some going as high as 1 million people. So there's been a huge and ongoing and systemic cover-up of the real legacy of nuclear waste and energy for decades now.
And that disaster is not over either, because they keep pouring concrete on it every few years, but the concrete continuously breaks down, as concrete is going to do anyway, but it's exacerbated by the fact that it's poured over top of, you know, the radioactive material, which just eats away at everything. Like, nothing survives in that kind of an environment, including nuclear power plants. I mean, I thought of this years ago. Like, they would talk about nuclear power plants, and they'd say, oh, it's got maybe a 40-year lifespan. And I'd think, okay, well, 40 years is going to be here before we know it. What are they supposed to do with this thing? Who's going to guard this forever? And there was never any kind of an answer about that. It's just one of those things that makes you go, ah. Anyway, tell us about the latest bang-up idea to solve this with an ice wall.
Yes. This is the grand idea that they've come up with. So basically, because the groundwater is being contaminated by the various leaks that are happening on site, both from the containment where they're storing the radioactive water that's accumulating at the site at the rate of one Olympic-sized swimming pool per week, and that they're scrambling to try to contain all of that water, also from the water that's leaking out from the damaged containment from the melted down nuclear reactors, units 1, 2, and 3 at the site, the groundwater has been contaminated, and of course that runs the risk of some of this contaminated radioactive water leaking into aquifers that feed other parts of Japan, and the radiation spreading all across the country. I mean, that's a horrific thought. So in order to try to contain this and to stop it from leaking out into the ocean, at least more so than it already is, they're going to freeze they're going to put permafrost. They're going to basically freeze the ground around the plant itself, so that the groundwater won't be able to migrate outside of that area. And this is basically, I mean, it's admitted to be a stopgap solution. It's never been tried before on the scale that they're talking about, and more likely than not, it's going to fail. But I think this is part of having to be seen to be doing something in order not to be exposed for doing nothing. And this is a pretty harebrained scheme, but one that, unfortunately, I mean, there has to be something done at this point. As I say, as this Olympic-sized swimming pool of radioactive water adds up every single week, and they are now at the point where they're going to run out of containment space, physical mm-hmm. space to store all of this contaminated water by November at the very, very latest. So they're already running out of area to do this, and they've already admitted that at some point they're going to have to start dumping some of this radioactive water directly out into the ocean, because there's nothing else they can do with it. And they're promising they'll decontaminate it to a whatever's deemed a safe level by the international community before they do so, but it's going to end up in the Pacific one way or another, which is exactly what we want to avoid. And it's a horrific situation that unfortunately continues to get worse, as just last month, more leaks were found in the containment that they're using to store this radioactive water. Initially reported as radiation that was 100 millisieverts per hour. That's the way that they measure the strength of the radiation, which is not a good thing, but relatively minor, I suppose you could say, until they admitted that the instruments that they'd been using to test that radioactive water were only capable of reading 100 millisieverts per hour. So when they brought in equipment that was capable of reading higher levels of radioactivity, lo and behold, it was actually 1,800 millisieverts per hour, which since has spiked up to 2,200 millisieverts per hour, which is enough to kill a human being in a few hours. So again, there's some some serious issues that are continuing to happen at the plant. And as bad as all of that news is about all of the leaks and the radioactive water, that still doesn't even address one of the major ongoing concerns at the site, which is at Unit Number 4, which did not melt down. It was offline at the time of the disaster, but it houses the spent fuel pool where 1,300 used fuel rods are currently sitting in a very precarious situation in a containment building that itself is threatening to collapse. And with 1,300 of these used fuel rod assemblies packed together in this tight space, it is a disaster waiting to happen. And now they've put all of the gear and the pieces in place to start removing those fuel rods, but it's going to be a very delicate operation. Nothing like this has ever been tried before. Not only is there the risk of the cranes that they're using to take these fuel rod assemblies out of there breaking down or dropping any of these fuel assemblies, but even if the used fuel rods get too close to each other, that can start a type of chain reaction. So there's all Kaboom. Sorts of dangers in this operation that's going to start in November, and even that's not the main news that's getting out there net right now because of all of these leaks.
Well, any news, ENENews.com, it's an energy news website, had a couple of interesting things. Arnie Gunderson, he's a nuclear expert from Fairgrounds Energy Education, said that the spent fuel rods are likely to break if they're pulled from the Unit 4 pool. And that because the racks are distorted and the rods are overheated, they're going to be stuck in there for a long time. On the topic of this ice wall, a nuclear consultant named John Large said that the ice wall will have to be maintained for 200 to 300 years. and he said if it is installed, the ice wall can crack and fissure the clay around the area and create leaks.
It would be funny if it wasn't so serious, but I mean, what else can you do but laugh at the ridiculous nature of this? And this is exactly right. I mean, just like the plants themselves, which have to be maintained in a constant state in order to prevent the meltdown, so too will this ice wall have to be maintained for hundreds of years into the future, regardless of whatever else is happening in the world, in order not to contaminate the oceans and ultimately the rest of the world, which is why this active containment idea for nuclear reactors is such a ridiculous and horrible way to do things. It breaks all ideas of safety engineering that would apply in any other industry, but it doesn't in the nuclear industry. And why is that? It is because the nuclear energy industry is nothing else than an adjunct of the nuclear armament industry. Mm-hmm. The uranium reactors that we have now that require all this active containment and which can break down at any time are the way they are precisely because they're so good at processing plutonium for nuclear weapons. And it doesn't have to be that way. There are designs for other types of nuclear reactors that rely, for example, on thorium salts, which are abundant and rely on passive containment so that they have to actively be maintained in a state of reaction. And if anything happened, like an earthquake or what have you, it would stop. The process would actually stop automatically, by the nature of the way these reactors work. But that idea has never been taken off the drawing board for anything more than limited tests because there's no money in that. Because, again, the nuclear industry is the nuclear armament industry. And until people understand that that death embrace that the two industries are in and the reason why the nuclear energy industry exists at all, despite the fact it's such economically, it makes no sense because all of these reactors require much, much more input than they ever really come out with economically. It is because of that embrace between the nuclear energy industry and the armament industry.
Isn't it amazing? There's always a BS front story for just about everything. You know, once you scratch a little bit below the nail polish, you go, ooh, what's that? Yeah, you know, BS.
That's exactly right. And it's from the inception of the nuclear energy industry and the Atoms for Peace that they were trying to sell the world on back in the 1950s. And it's particularly ironic that was sold so well here in Japan, where, of course, the population is absolutely horrified by the idea of nuclear weapons. And of course, Japan, for obvious reasons, is not a officially declared nuclear power. But the irony is that in embracing the nuclear energy industry, what they've done is create the perfect vehicle for creating nuclear weapons at the flip of a switch. I mean, Japan is not a nuclear arms power in name only, because at any time they could start producing nuclear weapons from the reactors that exist here in the country.
They probably have them.
Probably. I wouldn't doubt it, anyway. And there's a lot of indication that they have they do have some weapons, so you're exactly right.
Yep. James, thank you very much. We're all out of time. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and get your perspective from the other side of the planet. You're an asset to all grounded thinking people. So thanks.
I appreciate that.
You
thank you very much for having me on.
Great, and we'll like to get you back on again sometime soon. That's our program for this evening. You can keep up with James Corbett's work at corbettreport.com. That's C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Keep up with everything we do here at Far Out Radio by going to Far Out Radio, sign up for our free daily updates. That way you know who's going to be on the program. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow night with more Far Out Radio.